You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK Quad Cities NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today I'm very pleased to have as my guest a leading expert on public opinion who works for one of the top Republican polling firms in the United States. He's Robert Blizzard, and he's a partner with Public Opinion Strategies, which is based in Washington, D.C. I invited him on the show to discuss some fascinating research he and a colleague have been doing among voters very similar to those in the Quad Cities area, as you'll hear. He's going to tell you what he's found and why it's important to you as we move forward into the 2022 election cycle. I know that's the last thing people want to hear is more elections, but we got it. So, Robert, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, Robin. Should be fun.
I first heard you on another podcast. I'll give the props to Josh Kroshar, who's on our show as well. And this was right before the 2020 election. And you, I thought some of the research you found then wound up being spot on. Can we go back a little bit? Can you kind of fill our listeners in on how you did this and what you were hearing from folks?
Yeah. So we've worked with Public Opinion Strategies. We've worked with a partner on this research now, it's N2 America, and their goal is really to help Republicans in the suburbs, especially during the Trump era. So what we did both last cycle and then for the first 100 days of the Biden administration is we did some qualitative research. So qualitative is not a poll, not a statistically valid a sample of voters, but it's almost like focus groups or in-person research, if you will. And so what we wanted to do is really look at suburban voters across the country, and doing this research online, really allowed us to do that rather than having to travel to, Phoenix, Arizona, and Denver, Colorado, and suburban, Philadelphia, and all these places, and do all these in-person focus groups, especially during the pandemic. We did this research online, and what was cool about it was we got respondents from a number of different states across the country, from Arizona, Georgia, and Florida, Michigan, Iowa, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, all the, when you're watching the election results come in on election night or election week, as we had last year, and those kind of the key players, those key states that are always up for grabs, we're looking at those suburban voters. And, suburban voters in particular, they are, I would say, the quintessential swing audience in almost every election. The path to the White House goes through the suburbs, the path to the majorities in Congress and state houses, governor's mansions. I mean, you can't get those without, winning over in the suburbs. And, Biden narrowly won the suburbs in 2020. Trump narrowly won them in 16 over Hillary Clinton. They are that, again, quintessential, swing audience. And so what we wanted to do is really take a deeper dive with those voters, not just poll them and test the horse race here and there, but really understand, why they feel the way that they do. And, as you can probably guess, with a lot of the polling out there and what you're seeing even in corporate America, there's been a lot more emphasis, I would say, on, big data. And I think what happens with that is we lose some of that emotional intelligence, really understanding the why, behind voters' opinions and the choices that they can make. And it helps get a little more direction, a little more nuance besides just how that they feel. And look, we're living in an era, and I'm sure your listeners, would appreciate this. This is quite a wild, political era we're living in. Incredibly personal politics. And so I think tapping into that deeper level of voter motivation, it really can help provide, especially on our side, the Republicans, I'm sure the Democrats are doing the same thing. Give us a little bit of an advantage to understanding why people feel the way that they do, instead of just getting a horse race number, here and there.
I remember you talking during that first session with Josh that Trump really hurt himself with his performance in the first debate. And if our listeners remember, those who watched or read about it, he was on the attack, interrupting quite frequently and just kind of just disrupted the debate generally. That tells me he was doing pretty well before then, but his support dropped, but yet it kind of stayed at a competitive level on the down ballot races.
Yeah. I mean, to that point, we actually, one of the interesting things that we did was we had folks log in and react immediately in the aftermath of that first presidential debate. And oh boy, I mean, both Republicans and Democrats in our panel, as well as independent voters, you know, they described that debate as a dumpster fire. It was very uncomfortable to watch. You know, there was a woman from Arizona, I remember, said that it wasn't even a debate. You know, it was just a different version of her kids bickering over who gets the good share to watch TV. I mean, it was terrible. And what we saw in the qualitative research here was that suburban voters overwhelmingly thought Biden won the debate. And I think a lot of it had to do more with Trump losing the debate, if that makes sense, rather than Biden actually going on and winning the debate. There was just an avalanche of negative comments, you know, about Trump's attitude and his demeanor. And I think a lot of voters, especially when we were in the pandemic, there was a lot of issues going on, a lot of, you know, future-oriented policies that they were talking about. And a lot of voters, I think, were just, you know, very frustrated with that. But to the second point of kind of your question and your comment there, what we found also in our research was that a lot of these suburban voters, they are center-right fiscally, you know, in terms of the economy, on taxes, on spending, on fiscal issues. You know, they're a little bit more conservative, especially more so than what you might find in, you know, in the urban populations across, you know, cities and states. And they were a little concerned about, not necessarily Biden's, you know, character or his personal attributes, but they were concerned about, you know, the leftward tilt, the more progressive tilt to the Democratic Party. And so what I thought was really interesting is we actually asked a question really maybe a week or two out from Election Day among that panel. And a lot of suburban voters were talking about how they wanted to, you know, split their tickets, or they, you know, were kind of holding their nose a little bit voting for Biden just because they couldn't really handle, you know, another 4 years of Donald Trump. And so I think it also just speaks to these suburban voters in general. You know, they're more sophisticated. They take a bigger picture viewpoint on issues. You know, even when you look at taxes and the economy and spending, you know, they don't just look at how it affects them personally. They look how it affects the entire economy, their whole ecosystem that they live in. And, you know, it was interesting because, you know, there was very little ticket splitting, you know, in the election in 2020, the lowest we've seen in at least 20 years. But where that ticket splitting did occur was in a lot of suburban areas across the country where, you know, Republicans held on and won, you know, House seats, even though the President Trump may have lost the district.
I was just going to mention that all the polling showed huge gains for the Democrats in the Senate and the House. And I wonder, is it true, Robert, do you think that this either the pollsters were wrong or maybe you guys caught this before everybody else did, that there wasn't going to be that wave down ballot?
Well, I think it's a couple things. I think, I mean, number one, I mean, a lot of the polling out there in the public realm that a lot of people, you know, a lot of the analysts or the talking heads on TV, you know, point to make their, you know, handicap, you know, impressions of what's going to happen. I wouldn't say that it was necessarily wrong, but it's certainly, I don't think what we were seeing internally, you know, when we were polling for our candidates and even on the Democratic side, you know, when you look at what we're doing from a campaign standpoint, when we're polling, you know, our goal is really to, you know, try to win the race. And so we're testing messages, we're testing, much like we did here, you know, we're testing issue positions and, you know, basically how do we get to 50% of the vote, you know, plus one? You know, how do we win the race? Whereas I think a lot of the horse race polling out there that's in the public realm, you know, for example, they may have said, oh, you know, this candidate is up by 4 points, they're going to win, but they're not looking at how undecided voters are going to break. You know, they're not looking at, you know, what share of the electorate is going to be Republican versus how much does the Democratic candidate already have kind of locked in? You know, basically, where is there more room to grow? So there's a lot of that nuance in polling that we do on the Republican side, and I'm sure that my friends on the Democrat side do as well, that wasn't captured, you know, publicly. But I think it also shows that, you know, if you're just polling, you know, if you're just looking at horse race data, you know, it's limited. It's limiting in the fact that there's more out there. And I think that's part of the reason we did this study and why we continued it this year, and we'll probably do it, you know, hopefully going into the 22 cycle, because there's a lot more to this and really understanding a lot of the nuances and again, some of that emotional intelligence that you just can't capture just by asking, are you voting for Trump or Biden in a political poll?
With this same group of suburban voters, you seem to pick up on something that I think is very important heading into the 2020 cycle.
I think we're seeing the same things in some regards. I mean, I think first off, I think there's a large concern, and I think you're starting to see it when you look at Joe Biden's numbers in terms of his approval rating, and also a little bit in terms of the direction of the country. You know, do voters think things are moving in the right direction, or are they off on the wrong track? You're starting to get this sense now that the honeymoon with Biden is over. You know, when he took office, in January, that was a weird time, right? We just came out of the, insurrection at the Capitol. You know, then you go into an impeachment of Trump, when he left office. I mean, really the first 100 days, I mean, really only about half of those were really Biden centric. I mean, every time you'd open up the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or, even the local newspapers, there in the Quad Cities, it was all about the Trump impeachment. What's going on with Trump? What's happening with what happened at the riot at the Capitol? Very little about what Biden's doing. Very little about what's the new president's agenda. You know, Trump still dominated the news coverage. And so now that we've kind of moved past that, and also now that I think we've kind of started to turn the corner here in terms of public opinion on the pandemic, more voters, specifically the suburban voters, think that the worst of the pandemic is now, behind us. We are getting to a situation where the honeymoon with Biden is for sure, I think, over. I said it recently to another, I don't know if it's a podcast reporter, even though the honeymoon is over, I don't think suburban voters are really filing for divorce yet, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because I think they're still kind of keeping an eye on Biden and they do personally like him, but there's a lot of concerns now as we're moving past the executive order, period of his presidency into more, legislation. And you see that with all the spending and the infrastructure bill and, a tax increase and, what he's doing in terms of the climate. I mean, just now that we're out of the coronavirus and into other issues, we're starting to see some of those concerns from suburban voters that we saw last cycle start to reemerge a little bit. Just a concern, really, Robin, that there's going to be an overreach by the Democrats in Washington, which is something that, these suburban voters are really concerned about because they actually value checks and balances. And that was one of the things that they had wished that they could have gotten out of the 2020 election. And they may, they may try to fix that themselves, when they go to the voting booths in, next November.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And my guest today is Robert Blizzard, who's a partner with Public Opinion Strategies of Washington, D.C., Republican polling firm. He's been involved in some very interesting research with suburban voters over the past, at least year, I think, and heading into this next cycle. And why is it important? Well, because our region is going to be right in the middle again for the battle of the control of Congress. We've got an open seat now in the 17th district on the Illinois side. We've got on the Iowa side two Republican seats that are held by first term members, which will be very competitive, all based, again, on what happens with reapportionment. Again, as a matter of a technical thing to clear up here, we all think of cities, we think of Chicago and Des Moines, we think of suburbs, we think of cities nearby there. But you feel, as we talked earlier, you feel that like the Quad Cities, everybody knows what rural is, it's out in the country and all, but we're kind of in between there. But we do kind of fit the demographic profile of more traditional suburban voters here.
Yeah, no, I would say so for sure. I think especially when you have, when you have a larger than, I would say, average percentage of, let's say, college graduates, you have a little bit of a higher income base there, a lot of more employment, a lot more jobs. I'm sure there's traffic issues there as well. You commonly see in the suburbs. No, I think the Quad Cities would certainly classify as a suburban community. But no, you're right. It's maybe not necessarily as sexy as the, Maricopa in Arizona or, Bucks County or Delaware County in Pennsylvania or Oakland or Michigan and Oakland or Macomb in Michigan. But, I mean, there's a lot of those, I would say, maybe smaller suburban communities across the country, which, to your point, they're going to decide a lot of races in 22. You also have, potentially competitive governor's race in Iowa, and depending on what Chuck Grassley does in the Senate race in Iowa, if he retires or runs again, that could become competitive at some point. It's an interesting place kind of tucked in there between those states, because you're going to get a lot of action, and I'm assuming you're also going to see a lot of advertising, right, from a lot of different campaigns and independent expenditures on both sides.
Oh, yeah. It never stops, it seems. I'm curious, before the reintroduction there, you were talking about your current research. It seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that these suburban voters may be, as you talked about, after Trump's debate performance in the first debate, they kind of turned on him. It seemed like they were just looking for somebody. They were looking for maybe a return to just being kind of quiet, normalcy to a degree. But now they're getting a lot of these proposals, which just seem, and again, I don't want to, I'm just trying to interpret this objectively, but maybe, yeah. Do you get the sense they're overreaching a little bit with some of these proposals and maybe misinterpreting what the voters were really saying in 2020?
Well, I think there's a lot of that going on. I mean, I think when you look at terms of issues, I think that suburban voters are starting to wonder, and not just suburban voters, but I think all voters, they're starting to wonder what life's going to look like post-COVID. Again, I think we're on a tipping point on a lot of issues. The economy, what's it going to look like now? Not very good job numbers, in last week's report. Taxes and spending, what kind of immigration policy are we going to have? Basically, what's it going to be like to live and breathe in America now going forward, once we get past this? And I think what's interesting about the suburbs is, these voters now, I think, are looking at things differently, or at least through a different lens than they may have done before. School reopenings, I think, is a great example. And I'm not exactly sure, how all that went down where you guys live. But, and a lot of suburban voters, they didn't really know much about teachers' unions. They didn't know much about their school administration or who their school board members are. Now they do. They know a lot more about that. And again, on taxes and spending, especially for these more fiscally conservative voters in these suburban communities, they're very concerned about that. And I think in terms of overreach, I think that's you kind of hit the nail on the head even with the question, because that's the concern. And I think what voters are really looking at now, again, specifically suburban voters, it's almost a value proposition. I think they are starting to grow a little bit more concerned about, are they getting their money's worth from government? What exactly are we paying for in taxes? Schools have been closed. Government's going to keep spending. Here's another $2 trillion in infrastructure. Here's another $2 trillion in this. We're spending and spending and spending. And what are we as voters, what are we really getting out of this? What are these our priorities? Is this how we should be spending our money? And there's a growing concern about Democrats being in complete control. These voters want check and balances. They worry about overreach. And I think for Republicans, I think it's a great opportunity too. I think it's a great messaging opportunity for Republicans to talk about that. And I don't think it's going to fall on deaf ears, because I think there's a lot of voters now that we're kind of moving at least slowly past the Trump era. This is becoming much more, Biden, what's going on with Biden and D.C. and the Democrats and their administration. Midterm elections in particular typically are referendum election years. In 2018, Democrats did very well as a referendum on Trump. In 2010, and you go all the way back to about 94, Republicans did very well when they were referendums on, Obama and Clinton. And so if this, manifests into a referendum in 2022, that could be really good news for Republicans.
It just seems like both parties have such huge challenges internally. The Democrats have the battle between their moderates and their more progressive members. And now in the Republican Party, you've got really the specter of Trump hanging over everything. And even the vote this week that's going to be taking place on Liz Cheney, we're taping this Tuesday. It just seems like both parties are really have their own internal challenges. And when voters, it just seems to me, again, my own thought, when voters are ready to reject one party and they look to the other, it's almost like, is that really what we want? But we seem to be going back and forth in that phase. And we're not really getting the type of middle of the road candidates that we used to.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, the middle of the country has started to disappear. And not just, I think, in terms of, you know, their elected officials, but I also just think the voters themselves. I mean, there was a poll out last year, Robin, that had, I was almost 80% of Republican voters agreed with the statement that the Democratic Party was just a bunch of socialists. And there was, in that same poll, almost 80% of Democrats agreed with the statement that the Republican Party was just a bunch of racists. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got now, to your point of a middle, there is a Republican Party and a Democratic Party. They don't even really like each other now. I mean, there is a clear political divide. And what's interesting in the research that we've done is, even though voters believe that we are turning the corner from the pandemic, even though there's some optimism, if you will, about, you know, things are opening up and, you know, we can go do things again and we're going to get out of this mess. We see kind of a light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccines and the rollout of that. There's still a significant concern about the political divide in this country, how it's making its way into like everything. You know, it's not just politics anymore. It's, you know, the Major League Baseball game's getting moved. Dr. Seuss, you know, got canceled. Yeah. There's all that kind of stuff going on. And I think specifically on the parties, what I think is really interesting about the parties, and I've thought about this issue a lot because there are clearly divides now in both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party internally. But what I think is interesting is the Republican Party seems to be a lot more about personality, and I think the Democratic Party divide seems to be a lot more about policy. And I think that's what's going to be interesting to watch kind of evolve here over the next 2 years into the midterms and then even into the presidential race in 2024. Whereas the Republican Party, there's really not a big difference between the policy positions and issue positions of a Liz Cheney and Elise Stefanik. In fact, Elise Stefanik, you know, who'll be probably taking her place, is even viewed, I think, in a little bit more of a moderate. I mean, it's really much more driven about personality vis-a-vis a lot with Trump. But when you look at what's going on with the Democratic Party and the divides there, it's a lot more about policy. You know, and I think that's what's going to be interesting to watch is Biden. I think they've done a decent job of kind of holding off the far left right now, the progressives, the Bernie Sanders, the AOCs, the Elizabeth Warrens. But how long can they do that for? And at what point does it start to break a little bit? You know, Green New Deal, you know, student loan forgiveness, some of the sweeteners that the far left Democrats really want to push forward. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how can the Biden administration, you know, kind of keep them at bay a little bit. Because I just think it's interesting. You got one party that's totally fixated on personality, the Republican Party, and then you've got the Democratic Party where the clear divide, I think, is really on major policy differences.
Well, I've spent more time on my show really looking at the rural vote and the white working class vote since Trump's election. And I'm curious, yet, you know, the suburbs aren't, I haven't looked at that obviously as much as you have, but we had this continuing debate in looking at rural voters, working class voters, on what the dynamics between culture and economics and whether either or both are involved in how people have voted and how all these Obama-Trump counties have come about. Is that kind of the same? Do you see that in the suburban areas where is it more economics or more culture, or are they always just tied together when people make the decisions on how they vote?
Well, I think specifically on the rural vote and specifically just because, you know, in those rural communities, there's a lot of white working class voters. I mean, it's just demographically and, you know, and geographically where they are. What I think is most interesting about those voters in particular is I think they found a voice in Trump that I don't think that they had probably going back to, I would say, probably the Clintons, you know, Bill Clinton specifically, you know, back 15, 20 years ago. And they kind of developed this anger and this resentment. They've lost a lot of faith in institutions. I think the recession 2008, 2009 really broke the camel's back quite a bit with these voters. They saw bailouts going to banks. They saw bailouts going to auto industries. And, you know, I was doing focus groups at that time. And, you know, a lot of these voters were like, well, where's my bailout? You know, where's my help? Where's my support? You know, I'm working really hard. And I think also just a frustration of, you know, and almost really a populist streak you know, within these voters, that there's a lot of, you know, corporations doing really well. There's a lot of wealthy doing well. And I'm, you know, I'm not, and I'm working really hard for it. And so I think that the bottom line with when you look at those voters are is essentially they found a voice in Trump. And, you know, much like we saw from 2008 when Obama won with a unique coalition of voters, they did not come out to vote in 2010. And that's partly how Republicans did so well in the midterm elections. But guess what? They came right back out for him, you know, for Obama in 2012. You saw a similar thing happen from 2016 to 2020. In 2016, you know, a lot of these white working class voters, sometimes, you know, in some cases, in some states, people had never voted before, you know, going out to the polls and voting for Trump in 2016, kind of fed up with politics, fed up with the system, kind of a total outsider and somebody who basically was not going to put out the fires in D.C., but really more of an arsonist to D.C., if you will. You know, this new kind of group of voters that came out and very angry, frustrated voters with the direction of the country. Then they didn't come out in droves in 2018. But then guess what? They're right back there in 2020. So I think what's going to be interesting to watch is, especially for the Republican Party, can we recreate that coalition in 22 and 24, whether Trump's on the ballot or not, to get those voters back out to the polls and vote Republican? Because I think culturally, you know, they are much more attuned to the Republican Party on gun control, on abortion, on religion, on frustration with, you know, what's going on in Washington, kind of, you know, being more of an outsider and less establishment. And I think economically, I think that's kind of the ball game. You know, can we convert these voters, Trump voters, to Republican voters by offering an economic policy that they, you know, that they agree with?
Got about 30 seconds left. Which, my last question is this, which do you feel is more likely to flip in 2022, the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate?
Oh, boy. I think both of them I'm pretty optimistic about Republican chances in 22. I think it's going to be a referendum year on what's going on in D.C., which is complete, you know, Democratic control. I think there's growing frustration with overreach and spending and taxes and how we're only in May. I mean, who knows what the next year is going to what's going to unfold over the next year. I think that we are very likely going to be looking at Mitch McConnell, you know, retaking the majority leadership spot and Kevin McCarthy becoming speaker in 22. I think we're primed for a really good year. So I think I would take choice C. I think both of them are likely to flip back to Republican hands in 22.
All the above. That fair enough. Robert Blizzard, who's a partner with Public Opinion Strategies, a Republican polling firm in Washington, has been my guest today on Heartland Politics. Fascinating discussion on some important research on suburban voters, which again is similar to what the Quad City demographic profile is. And so we'll have you back at some point and follow this more closely. But thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Robin. Enjoyed it.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.